We're in the seventh chapter of Deuteronomy. Last time we'd gotten down to the fifth verse, but we want to kind of start back in the beginning and then lead back up into our thought at the fifth verse. The situation here is Moses is speaking to the children of Israel as they are standing on the, encamped on the banks of the Jordan River, ready to shortly make their crossing over into the Canaan land. And the book of this book of Deuteronomy is devoted to his instructions to them to prepare them to be able to go in and to take the land and then to also satisfactorily and successfully serve God. And that's really what it's all about, is being able to serve God. And so he's reminding them of things that have happened and of laws that God has given and reasons for these laws so that they then will have ingrained into themselves the true plan of God and be truly converted followers of the living God. So we'll read these first five verses over again and briefly comment on them. It begins, Deuteronomy 7, verse 1, "When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou." Now he names these seven nations. These are not the only seven nations they had to deal with, but he does give some pretty finite limitations to their nations to which they're going to be involved with. They weren't just able to go in there and commit wholesale slaughter or attack anybody they wanted to, but God was guiding and directing them as to exactly who they were going to be involved with. He names these seven nations. Verse 2, "And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them." So he would deliver the nation to them, and they were to do their part to utterly destroy them, to smite them, and to make no covenant, and to show no mercy. Now, this is a very clear and plain avenue that they were to take in their dealings with these nations. Verse 3, "Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and destroy thee suddenly." So he tells them not to make the marriages, and the reason is because these marriages would turn them away from the true and living God. Now these principles that he's giving these people of what to do after they get into Canaan and how to successfully serve God, these principles still stay with us today. Although our warfare is not carnal, we do not use the weapons of carnal warfare according to the New Testament teaching, we still have a spiritual warfare that we're engaged in, and God does clearly name the enemy, and we are then to treat that enemy the same way that he would have these people to treat their enemies. And this would certainly be true in the area of marrying out of the church or marrying out of the family of God. Not to make marriages with them, because when you do, then you are going to cause the son or the daughter to serve other gods. They're going to be turned away to serve other gods. There'll be a tremendous, tremendous pressure and influence upon them to give some kind of credence, some kind of recognition to these other gods or other religious ways. Ways besides what God would have us to do. So this is just a law. It's a spiritual law. We cannot refute the law. We may think that we can involve ourselves in these marriages or let our children involve themselves in these marriages and not have this happen, but it invariably will happen because it is a law. Now, unless this person that they marry is turned away from those gods, if they continue to serve them, if they continue to follow in those ways, then that influence is going to be leached through into the rest of the family, that is, the rest of the children that are born out to that union, and there's no way that the influence can be completely, absolutely refuted. Then in verse 5 he says, "But thus shall you deal with them," and we got down to this verse last time, "you shall destroy their altars and break down their images, and cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire." Now, everything that had to do with their way of worship, the things that they held as being spiritual ways, high and holy ways, the ways they had of serving their gods were to be completely annihilated. And he names specifically what he's talking about. You shall destroy their altars, that is, the altars that they used for their sacrifice and their worship. And you shall break down their images. And I believe this word images really should be pillars. And as you know, many of the idolatrous gods and religions had these tall pillars that they raised up, these obelisks, which actually in many ways were giant phallic symbols, and they held these as very holy things, sacred things. Well, the Israelites were not to allow those things to stand. And he says, cut down their groves. These groves were these trees and areas of poles in which they had arranged or planted and provided for them to render their worship in, and burn their graven images with fire. Just destroy the graven images by burning them with fire. Now he tells them that's the way to deal with these things. And this was not completely carried out. They did go in and they left the groves. And it would be a real human and natural thing for us to assume, well, here's a nice place. It's been already set aside and fully groomed and cared for where these people are worshiping. Let's just go ahead and use the same place and we'll worship there too. God did not want that, because when that began to happen, then it was just the first step toward them taking up the ways of those idolatrous gods. And that's human nature. It's just as true today as it was then. Now, for example, when he says to destroy their images or pillars, these obelisks, today we find that the Catholic Church has taken an obelisk that comes from an idolatrous temple, and they've placed that obelisk right in the middle of the square of St. Peter's Basilica, their largest and most widely used cathedral. This obelisk has been placed there. I don't know what it was put there for, but it is very definitely an idolatrous symbol. It was previously used as an idolatrous means of worship, but it's been placed there as some kind of a high and holy symbol. You see how it's easy for man to look upon these things as something great. God had no use for them. He did not want them to be allowed to continue to even exist. They were to be destroyed. And we'll see as we get further on in this chapter that he reiterates this. Now, this same teaching is given in Exodus 23:24 and also Exodus 34:13. But I would like to look into a New Testament area and show how that same principle applies to us today. In 2 Corinthians 10, beginning with the third verse, Paul says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh." 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3. "We walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds." There's something we're to pull down that he calls a stronghold. And it doesn't mean that it's an easy job to do just because it's not carnal. It's a spiritual warfare. But this spiritual warfare is still a very definite, difficult, grueling, hard thing to accomplish. And it takes mighty weapons. And the weapons that we have are mighty through God, and they're designed for pulling down strongholds. And the figure that Paul gives here would be like an army attacking a walled city, and they would have maybe a giant weapon that was called the claw, that was designed to go up and to actually batter down a brick wall to weaken the wall or to put a hole in it. There were other mighty weapons that they used back then, but this one that was called the claw would be kind of the same figure here that Paul is using, to the pulling down of strongholds. And what this really is doing, he names in the fifth verse, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God. Now, anything that is against God, any high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, what are we as Christians to do? We're to cast it down. We're not to allow it to continue to stand. Certainly not in our lives, not in our philosophy or our way of thought. We do not give any credence to it. We do not give any homage to it. We do not pay respect to it. We do not recognize it as being what people claim it to be. So that false religions, we do not recognize them as being a true religion, having any power, having any hold on us, or do we bow down and serve and pay them any kind of respect? We do not recognize any high thing. We cast it down, any high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And he says, further casting down imaginations, these things that are not true. Anything that's the truth is not an imagination. But anything that is strictly a product of imagination is not the truth. And so we're opposed to anything that is not the truth. We're only in favor of those things that are consistent with the truth. So if something is an imagination, that if it's an invention of man, then we cast it down. Just as they were to tear down the groves, just as they were to burn the images, just as they were to tear down the altars and the pillars, we then today spiritually cast these same things down. And furthermore, in our warfare, he says, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So that any thought that we come across that is consistent with and conducive to the obedience of Christ, we capture that thought. We make it a part of us. We want it. Whereas these other things, we repel against and destroy them. So you see the kind of warfare we're in is spiritual, but it's on the same plane as theirs was physically against idolatry. And of course, sometimes we even have to, many times we have to take the proper attitude towards physical symbols that people use to perpetuate their spiritual wickedness. All right, again, in Acts, the 19th chapter, we have an example where the people there in the city of Ephesus who were following after witchcraft and things that are consistent with idolatry, when they learned the truth, they burned their books that told how to practice these ungodly ways. In Acts 19, verse 19, many of them also which used curious arts brought their books together and burned them before all men, and they counted the price of them and found it 50,000 pieces of silver. So it seems they had a big bonfire there upon that occasion, Acts 19:19, in the city of Ephesus, and they destroyed these books that were very valuable that told how to practice these curious arts of witchcraft. And so it is with us today. When we find that we've got something that's not the truth, then we are so opposed to it that we don't even care about allowing it to exist, and we just as soon to burn it. Now, there are groups today who are coming together and burning their rock records. And this is one way to get rid of those things that are so filthy, that are so ungodly, that they do not deserve even to be allowed to continue to exist, so that somebody else doesn't come along and be influenced by them. So we see then how this principle applies to us today. So each one of us in our own individual private lives must be most careful that we do not allow these things of idolatry, these things of the world, to influence us by allowing them to have any kind of stature or power or significance to us. And we see these things on every hand. I've had the last two or three days two or three people to make a statement and then knock on wood. Say, let me knock on wood when I say that. I haven't been sick in 6 months now. Let me knock on wood. And what are they appealing to? There's some kind of a spiritual power somewhere, somehow or other, that they're appealing to when they do that. Just yesterday, I sneezed and somebody said, bless you. Here again, this old idolatrous way that has no significance whatsoever, no power whatsoever, but somebody is appealing to it in their mind. And so these are the things that we tear down today. Every imagination and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, we tear those things down. And so they mean nothing to us. We would never need to knock on wood when we make a statement, because somehow or other it's going to mean bad fortune happens to us because we didn't knock on the wood. You see, and there's just hundreds of these things on every hand, and that's what we're warring against. We cannot allow those old things to stand in our mind. It'd be the same as our going and worshiping in the groves and using the altars and the idols that those people in Canaan used before it was taken over by God's people. And then he gives the reason for this in verse 6. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. Now this, if we didn't have anything any different from this right here. This would be reason enough. The reason you're not to be tainted and contaminated with these idolatrous ways is because thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. I want you to be separate. I want you to be clean and pure and to be different. You're a holy people. Each parent has experienced this feeling. They have a little baby that's born into the family, and that little baby is so pure and so holy and so clean and so free from sin and any thought of sin. But as this baby grows, and as this baby then starts taking on other activities and gets involved with things of the world, school, for example, or the neighbor's kids or whatever, then we see that little baby being tainted and being influenced by things that are not the right things. And we say, well, I don't want you to be that way because you're a holy child. You're holy. You're somebody that's separate and apart. You're mine. And I want you to be like me. You're mine. And it breaks the hearts of parents to see their children when they come back and not like them. They're not like the parents. And this is the way it is with God. When God's people are not like He is, then God is most unhappy. He says, for thou art a holy people, unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto Himself, above all people that are upon the face of the earth. You're just not to be like these other people. You're to be above all people on the face of the earth. He's chosen you to be that way. He's chosen you to be a special people. Now, He didn't make you that way, but He's chosen you to be that way. He chose you. You didn't choose Him. He chose you. And here again, we have that same analogy with a parent and a child. The child did not choose the parents. The parents choose to love that child. They show the child love before the child shows the parent any love. They go through all of the problems of raising that baby from infancy. We're talking about feeding it and worrying about it and caring for it when it's sick and changing the diapers and trying to make it comfortable and all the things that are necessary. Hour after hour after hour before that child is even capable of responding to any kind of love. And all the parent asks of that child is that they be my child and that they return love to me. They're not asking for money or asking for anything that'll make them famous or power or asking to be have a servant or a slave. All they're asking is just love me like a child. But yet the parent has to do all of his first. He shows his love first before he gets anything back out of the child. And so it is with God. God shows His love first. He's already done His work. His work is done. All we have to do is take advantage of it. Our sins can be forgiven simply by doing what God would ask us to do. God's already done the work for it. And before we show Him any love, He's already committed Himself. And all He asks back out of it is that we be His child. We not be like the world, but we be like He would want us to be. And it's a very heartbreaking thing then when all that love has already been done and already been given to that child, then that child decides, no, I'm not going to be like the parent. I'm going to be like the world, like those that did never show me this love, like those that did not raise me, those that did not care for me, those that didn't even know I even existed. I'm going to go that way rather than the way of the parent. And so it is with God. We turn to these other gods that did nothing for us. Knocking on wood. That has never done anything for us. It's never given us any good thing whatsoever. It has no power. It is an imagination. It does not exist. But we turn to that rather than to the high and holy God. And what do you think God would think about that? Or we call upon some other name other than God. Or we allow ourselves to be duped into practicing something that comes from a man's imagination, did not come from God. God's the one that showed the love. God's the one that provided all this. But yet we turn from that to something that means nothing. You see the analogy, and you see then how these principles apply now just as well as they did then. And he goes on and explains just how this happened. or just how meaningful this is. Verse 7, the Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people. He didn't choose you because you were some mighty great people. I'd like to read a verse from Proverbs 14, verse 28, just to emphasize this point. Proverbs 14, verse 28, in the multitude of people is the king's honor, but in the want of people is the destruction of the prince. Now what he's saying here is that when you got a powerful people, a lot of people, a strong, mighty, numerous people in a nation, that gives the king a lot of honor. This king has more power. But when you have a nation that has a want of people, just a few people there, he says this is the destruction of the prince. And so it is, when you've got a great, mighty people, then the king has more honor. And he wants to cater to that people. In this nation, the politicians, for example, they want to do the things that will get them the most votes, because that's the way you get the honors, by having the most people follow you. But that's not the way it is with God. God said he didn't choose you because you were the most in number, because you were a mighty people. Well, he said, for ye were the fewest of all people. So he doesn't get honor. He doesn't get honor because he's chosen a great number of people. He can't say, I've got the vast majority of all the world now recognizing me, because all this mighty number of people. He's chosen a little old measly few number out here to be his people. And so if he's done that, certainly these few ought to do all within their power to please him. Because he didn't have anybody else to please him. He didn't choose the vast multitude. He just chose the few. And here it is again, like parents and children. The parents have a few children. Maybe one, maybe two, maybe three, whatever number. But of all the vast multitude of children in the world, those are the children that these parents have given their all for. Haven't given their all for the other children. And so if those fail to honor, then none honor as parents. And the same is true. If God's people fail to honor him as God, then no people honor him as God. Because he's just chosen a few people to honor him. So we see then that God didn't just set out here to pick out the most powerful, the most boastful, the most influential people that he could find. He picked the people that were the fewest in number to be his people. And that seems to have always been true. There's always a remnant left. And that remnant happens to be the ones who then are serving God. For example, after these people several hundred years later were carried into captivity in Babylon, and when the time came for them to come back to Jerusalem, only a remnant came back. Just a few thousand came back. The vast majority stayed in Babylon. So God started over with the remnant. And the same is true of the church. Of all the people who claim to be following God, there's only a very few who are really, truly the church. Only a few of the church. And Jesus said, narrow is the way that leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. For broad is the gate, and wide is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. So it's always said they're just going to be the few. And so you see then how much more important it is for us then, if we're a part of that few, how much more important it is for us to really, truly worship and recognize the true God. Because if we don't recognize him, nobody recognizes him. Because he's just chosen the few. So verse 8, but because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. These people here that are few in number, they really were slaves. They were a group of bondmen located down in Egypt. And the first time in the history of mankind, God brought a people out of bondage as a nation and claimed them to be His. And the reason He did this? Two reasons. One was because He loved them. He did it because He loved them. And the other is because He would keep the oath which He had sworn unto their fathers. He'd sworn an oath with their fathers, and God's true to His word. God does live up to His word. When He makes an agreement, when He makes a covenant, when He swears an oath, God lives up to it. And if we can just find out what His agreements have been, we know what He's going to do. And He made an oath with the fathers of these people. And because of that oath, and because of the fact that He loved them, He brought them out of that bondage. Verse 9. Know therefore that the Lord thy God, He is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love Him, and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations. So He says, in view of this fact then, that I brought you out because I loved you and because I was living up to my oath, in view of that fact, you should know then, know that the Lord thy God, He is God. There's not any other God. All these other nations that have a God are gods. There are no other gods. Those are just imaginations. Those are fallacies. The Lord your God, He is God. You know, we teach that in the church. And people claim that we are narrow-minded and that we are bigoted and we are this and that and the other. But this is what God has taught His people all along. His people have been taught that their God is the God. There's not room for any other God. There's not room for a different God. There's no place. There is no other God. There is no different God. There is no God that has a little different shade of principles about Him. This is the God. God's taught this all along. It may seem like that we are conceited, that we are narrow-minded, but this is the way the Bible teaches. If you're going to follow the Bible, this is what the Bible teaches. He doesn't leave any room for any other nation to have any other God. No room for any other God. Know, that, therefore, that the Lord thy God, He is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love Him, and keep His commandments for 1,000 generations. Now those that love Him, God keeps the covenant with them. God has mercy with them, those that love Him. And He says, if they keep His commandments, He does it to 1,000 generations, which would be many, many more generations than we can imagine existing. I understand that today, if you were to go back from one generation to the next and take a message from Adam, Adam gave a message and just passed it on by word of mouth, one generation to the next, that a message from Adam to us would only have to go through about 70 people. Well, God, that'd be 70 generations. But God keeps His commandments to 1,000 generations. We could go for 900 more generations. Figuratively speaking here, of course. There's no end to how faithful God will be if people just keep His commandments. He never runs out of faithfulness if the generations will keep His commandments. So God is not that far removed from us. We're right in the line. We're right towards the head of the line, you might say, when it comes to generations, running out of generations. We have near got to 1,000 generations. And God's ready to be faithful to us if we keep His commandments. That's the key. Keep His commandments. But now look on the other hand here, verse 10. And repayeth them that hate Him to their face. Those that hate Him, He repays to their face. To destroy them. Now who are those that hate Him? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is all these other nations that have all these false gods, those are the people that hate Him. And that would have to be true, I suppose, from the context that's given here. They do hate Him. The word hate simply means to love less. But when you really get down to it, if you want to know what it would really, really immediately mean, those that know him as the true God and then turn from him, those are the ones that truly could be said to hate him. These people who've never known him can't near hate God like those who've known him, those who've experienced his love, those who've experienced being his son, and then they turn to another God, to another thing. They truly could be said to hate him. Now, what does he say about those? He repayeth them that hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack to him that hateth him. He will repay him to his face. So the Christian who's turned against God has one promise here to look forward to of being repaid to his face, to be destroyed. So it concludes in verse 11. Thou shalt therefore keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command thee this day to do them. Keep them and do them. Not enough just to keep them. You keep them for the purpose of doing them. Kind of like a person having a Bible and never reading it, never studying it, never knowing what it says. He's keeping the Bible, all right. He's keeping all the word there, but he's not doing it. You keep them to do them. And so, he's given some very, very good reason for this. So, verse 12. Wherefore, it shall come to pass, if you hearken to these judgments, to keep and to do them, that the Lord thy God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he sware unto thy fathers. Now, see, there's a condition here. It shall come to pass if. The condition is if you hearken to these judgments and keep and do them. Hearken means to listen. If you listen to them, if you keep them, and if you do them. If you do this, then the Lord is going to keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he sware unto thy fathers. It's conditional. And probably every promise that we have from God is a conditional promise. For example, in the New Testament, one of the most outstanding conditional promises that I can think of is in Colossians 1, verse 23. Well, let me read a little bit more of that passage. Colossians, the first chapter, verse 21. And you that were sometimes alienated and enemies in your minds by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight. If you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you've heard and which is preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. See, there's an if there. God's going to do all these things. He's going to present you holy. He's going to make you unblameable and unreprovable in his sight. But there's a condition. If you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel. Conditions. So here he says, I'm going to keep to you the covenant and the mercy which you swear to thy fathers if you hearken to these judgments to keep and to do them. Now, he elaborates on this a little further. You see, that verse ends with a colon. So we're going to have some explanation of what some of this is that God's going to do. He will love thee and bless thee and multiply thee. Three things there. Love you. Oh, of all the things I would want to have love me would be God. I'd want God to love me. And when he loves, that means he doesn't do anything to work any ill toward me. Now, that's quite different from those who hate him. He's going to withstand them to the face. He's going to repay them that hate him to their face to destroy them. But I want him to love me, and so that he'll act toward me to do no evil, no harm toward me. He will love them. The second thing is, and bless thee. Now, you know, there are a lot of things we can love and maybe not be in a position to bless. We might have a strong feeling for a person, but may not be able to do anything to bring about any blessing toward that person. Although we do love them. We just don't hurt them, but we can't do anything for them. But God can bless us. So in addition to his love, he can bless us. Give us all of the good things that go with this life. I don't mean just the things that make us live a life of luxury and ease, but I mean the things that cause us to lead a life of fullness. A full, beneficial, satisfying life. He can bless us. And then he says, and multiply thee. Multiply thee. We read a little bit more about this multiplying. In the next verse he says, thou shalt be blessed above all people. There shall not be male nor female barren among you or among your cattle. So multiply then would mean that you would bear offspring. You know, as we encounter the many, many severe trials and disappointments and persecutions that go with having a family, all goes back to what I was talking about a few minutes ago about having these children, and they're so close, they're so holy, they're so much a part of us, and then we see them turn, we see them change. It just makes a parent just have in their minds, and I've thought this several times myself, if I had to do over again, would I even have any children? I believe if I just had a decision to make all over again, I just wouldn't even have any. How much easier life would be, how much a tremendous problem I would be eliminated from experiencing just by not having to worry with the rearing of children. And it almost seemed like it would be the thing to do. And I look around and I see people today who are not married, or maybe who are married and who do not have children, and I say how easy they've got it. They do not know how many problems are being spared just by not having to go through all of the tortures of raising children in this society. But then as we look and see God's way is that we do multiply, that we do bear offspring. And one of the ways that he considers then that he blessed his people is that he multiplied them. Verse 13 says, and multiply thee, he will also bless the fruit of thy womb and the fruit of thy land, thy corn and thy wine and thine oil and the increase of thy kine and the flocks of thy sheep. In the land which he sware unto thy fathers to give thee, thou shalt be blessed above all people. There shall not be male or female barren among you or among your cattle. God doesn't intend that we be barren. He intends that we have offspring. And so we see then that even though it seems to be the hard way to go in a lot of ways, it is the way that God would have us to go. To have offspring. And a society in which there are people who do not bear offspring, who do not intend to, who do not want to, who do not have any desire to, and who even are perverted to the point of being living a life like a homosexual. This then is a society that has parasites who are not being productive or contributing to the populace as God would have them to. God has us. He wants us to have offspring. And this is one of the ways that he considered then of as a part of his blessing to them, that they wouldn't be barren, but they could have offspring. He says, there should not be male or female barren among you or among your cattle. And so we see then that a major part of our lives are spent in this endeavor of having offspring. A large part of all of the work that we do is dedicated to having offspring. When we're younger and we have the little babes in arms, there's a lot of physical work involved with the actual rearing of the children and the providing of all the things that need to be provided. If we buy another house, we buy a house that's big enough to provide for another bedroom or another bathroom or another for this family that we have. When we buy a car, we buy one with the eye, can we carry the children in there okay? And then there's all the matter of educating and preparing them to be able to provide for themselves. And so the major part of our lives and of our energies go into this rearing of the children. And it's so typical in nature. As I think about the little parakeets, Their main aim and goal in life is to reproduce themselves, to raise other babies. And when you get a pair of parakeets that are being productive, they no more than get one little batch of birds off the nest, so they've already got more coming, and they just completely wear themselves out. The mother and the daddy both completely exhaust themselves physically. Their feathers are ruffled, they lose weight, they're susceptible to diseases because their whole life is going into raising these little babies. The babies are more important than anything else in the world. And so it's true of us humans. As we look back on our lives, we see that the bulk of all of our energies go into raising these little babies. Regardless of how they turn out, we've already put an end to them before we know how they're going to turn out. And this is the way it is that God would have us to do. He intends that we be fruitful and that we multiply. That's intended. And so it's taught here as they get into the land. He's going to bless you so there won't be a man or a woman, a male or a female, who will be barren. All will be then blessed by being able to multiply. Then the next thing he mentions is really interesting. Verse 15, and the Lord will take away from thee all sickness, and will put none of the evil diseases of Egypt, which thou knowest, upon thee, but will lay them upon all them that hate thee. Now what he's really saying here is, if you follow my commands, if you do these things, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to love you. I'm going to multiply you. I'm going to make it so that you're not barren. All your cattle, all your crops. And I'm going to also see that you don't have the diseases, especially those diseases that were so common among the people in Egypt. I won't put those diseases upon you. And so what he really seems to be saying is, you put off the ways of the Egyptians, and I see to it that you also are able to put off the diseases of the Egyptians. And this is a deep subject now about disease and sin. How much disease is connected with sin? How much when we get sick, when we lose our health, how much can we say, well, this has happened to me because I've sinned? It's difficult to say in some of these areas. But we do know that there are some diseases that are peculiar to sin. For example, the venereal diseases. A man and woman get married and they haven't had any kind of illicit sexual contact. They never have to worry about getting a venereal disease, unless it be most unusual circumstances. But when a venereal disease is involved, it just almost always has to be connected with a sin. Certain diseases go with sins. And exactly what diseases he's talking about here, I do not know. Some people have even gone so far to say that God uses diseases. They are his instruments to bring about punishment, to bring about suffering because of disobedience. I can't go that far to say. But I can say this verse is definitely teaching a certain freedom from sickness if they'll keep his commandments. And we also know that all of the things that God would have us to do, all of the things are compatible with a healthy life. There's not anything God would have us to do that in any way jeopardizes our health, but everything.